As kids are making their way out, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take, we're not going to take any more than like 15 seconds here to do this. I want you to think of, and I want you to share with someone around you, what your favorite movie is that's based, even if it's loosely based, based on something in the Bible, okay? You got 15 seconds. Tell your neighbor, what's one of your favorite movies that you've seen that's based on a story in the Bible? All right. Time's up. Time's up. Sorry. Time's up. All right. I'm really interested. It may not feel like a super long list of options here. I'm interested, just as you were talking there for a brief few moments, what were some of the names? What were some of the movies that came up? Does somebody have the guts? Shout one out. Prince of Egypt. Noah. Ben-Hur. Ben-Hur, yeah. Wait. I'm sorry, I'm missing. You know, that's, Michael, that's a great answer. That's a great answer. You know how many times after seeing that movie when I was a kid and any of the Old Testament stories that involved the Ark of the Covenant came up, how terrified I was? Because of that movie and the face melting, oh my goodness, that scarred some of my Bible reading. You know, in my house, I think probably the one we watched the most was The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston. Okay, great one. At least that's kind of what I thought until I got to be a little bit older. I mean, we weren't like biblically illiterate in our house. When I got a little older and I started studying the Bible more seriously, I started to realize that movie took quite a bit of liberties with the story in some interesting ways. I mean, one of which kind of feels like when you actually go back and you read Exodus, you go, wait, that wasn't in there? One of the most obvious ones is like, you know, this feuding brothers story between Pharaoh and Moses. And yeah, you can kind of imply because the old Pharaoh's daughter had adopted Moses coming out of the Nile. You could kind of imply, yeah, the new Pharaoh would probably have been a brother with Moses. But there's not this like sibling rivalry. I mean, I love Prince of Egypt too. That's kind of like a key plot line in that movie. That's not there. Oh, another one the Ten Commandments got that was like, wait, how in the world did you try to sneak this in? Was this whole like the wife of the new Pharaoh is secretly in love with Moses? You remember that whole plot line in the Ten Commandments? I'm like, that's not in the Bible anywhere. Where is this coming from? You know, another thing that was really interesting to me that stood out to me as I got a little bit more serious about reading the Bible and studying the scripture was I kind of had in my mind after, I don't know, we watched that movie. It felt like two or three times a year. I don't know why. There wasn't a lot of options in a Christian house when you're like, we're trying to stay away from secular movies. So I don't know. This was what was in my head. I pictured when Moses went to Pharaoh, because I saw that movie so many times. It's kind of a theme in Prince of Egypt too, that the main thing that God wanted to communicate through Moses to Pharaoh was, let my people go because I really love freedom and I'm anti-slavery. And like those things are true, but then I actually looked at the story and it's like, wait a second. That's not explicitly what God says through Moses to Pharaoh. And on the surface, what he says to Pharaoh might come across as a little bit more boring than that to us, and actually a lot more strange than, hey, I just kind of love freedom, so let my people go. Let's look at it together here. This is a really interesting, I mean, I don't know the last time you opened up to the book of Exodus. Let's look at this here. So this is like the first encounter between Moses and his right-hand man, Aaron, and the Pharaoh. Let's look at Exodus 5:1 together. We're going to be going throughout the book of Exodus this morning. Exodus 5:1, and we can see that God's communication through Moses to Pharaoh, he's actually communicating something different, and it feels a little bit strange. Afterwards, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel says, let my people go so that they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness? What? Are we talking like the best Hebrew rock bands are going to get together and we're going to have like a Woodstock out here? Coachella, for some of you in my generation or younger, a festival? What about like, let my people go because freedom? And it's like, oh, wait, you just want them to go out in the wilderness and have a festival? What's a festival? Now, as we go, that's really strange. I don't remember it like that. You know, I think, you picture this scene and you go, well, I wonder if Pharaoh is going, that's a really strange request. But if you notice, just go down to verse 2, Pharaoh's response isn't like, dude, what's a festival? What are you talking about? Pharaoh's not perplexed at what a festival is. He's perplexed because he doesn't know who Yahweh is, the God of the Hebrew people. So if we look at verse 2 here, we can see Pharaoh's response. Let's see here. There we go. Who is the Lord? So the Lord there in Hebrew is Yahweh. Who is Yahweh that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, I do not know Yahweh, and will not let Israel go. It's like the Pharaoh's telling Moses, I understand your request. I get, yeah, going out, having a festival. We're going to cover that in a moment. I know what that is, but I have no idea who your God is. We've got tons of gods around here in Egypt. We've got many of them, and I've just never heard of this Yahweh you speak of. I don't recognize him, so your request for time off is denied. Okay? Now, every major civilization and culture in the ancient Near East knew what a festival was. We just don't get it. And every culture at that time had important festivals that they practiced and they celebrated together. Festivals were a consecrated time where people would set aside time on a calendar, similar to like a holiday celebration, and they would dedicate a festival to a particular god or multiple gods. The ancient Egyptians had a number of festivals that they would celebrate throughout the year, which they saw as a way of honoring specific gods. And in honoring these gods, you were doing something. You were trying to keep the cosmic order in balance. You were trying to have those gods actually inhabit you. So while we could say, yes, there are definitely differences if you were to go, let's say, ancient Egyptian festival, you stop in at one of those and you go over to an ancient Canaanite festival, there would be differences, just like we have differences when you go from church to church and how people worship. But there are some basic ingredients of an ancient festival that we need to understand to really appreciate what God ends up calling Israel to out in the wilderness. The first thing, common ingredient, all of these festivals, you're going to make sacrifices to a god that you were worshiping at this festival. It could be food, it could be grain, even in some cases, it could be even human sacrifice. These are expressions to that particular god that you're saying to that god, I believe you are worth something. You're worth this attention, and I'm going to sacrifice something of value to you to demonstrate your worth. This is a way that people said, you are worth my attention. And that's an important point. So secondly, so the first one, right, you have sacrifices. You're saying to the god, you're worthy of my attention. You're worthy of this. You also had priests. There were always priests that would try to invoke the blessing and favor of those specific gods to keep the cosmic order in balance. You would also have music and dancing. Oftentimes the music, the explicit purpose of the music, would be to try to induce in those who are participating in the festival, get them into almost like a trance-like state. So it would have been common where maybe you'd have like repetitive patterns of rhythm that almost serve this kind of hypnotic function. The goal is that the music is getting you into this different state of consciousness. And they believed, they wouldn't have called it consciousness, they believed that that state opened you up more to have communication with your god or gods. Not only did they have music, but you would also have lots and lots of eating and drinking. This is, again, an important part of the music is in service of kind of like altering your state of consciousness, trying to make you open to the gods or spirits. But then the drinking plays an important part too. Because the drinking, well, I mean, we all know what enough amounts of alcohol do. It changes your state of consciousness. And so what they're trying to do here, they're actually in these ancient festivals, they're trying to open themselves up to be inhabited by those gods. In Egypt, in ancient Egypt, you explicitly had a designated festival that was called the Festival of Drunkenness. That was the name of one of their festivals. You can imagine what happened at that festival. And that was to worship the gods Hathor and Sekhmet. Now, this last feature, I'm going to try to keep as PG as possible because occasionally I know we have children in here. But I need to also at the same time communicate how dark and graphically horrific these ancient pagan festivals were as well. Another common feature was after you kind of got into this drunken, frenzied state, you would have these very, very X-rated rituals that would happen with a designated priestess or what they might call a sacred prostitute. And based on some of the historical evidence that scholars of the ancient Near East have dug up, we could say, it's really hard to come up with a best comparison, but to try to keep it appropriate for general audiences. But maybe if you've seen over the last couple of years any of the allegations in the news about maybe what happens in the world of Jeffrey Epstein, or more recently, Diddy, back in my day, he was Puff Daddy. If you've seen any of those horrific allegations, that actually gives you a picture of what went on as the climactic moment of so many of these ancient Near Eastern celebrations. Again, altered state of consciousness, we're trying to open ourselves up to these gods or spirits, and as we do that, they're getting into this drunken, frenzied state, and then terrible, horrific things most often happen. Now, so when Pharaoh hears Moses say, Yahweh wants the Hebrew people to go out in the wilderness to have a festival, this is probably what he's picturing. And actually, this is probably what the Israelites are picturing too. They've been in Egypt for 400 years. They don't know anything else other than that culture. So when Moses is telling them, hey, here's the plan, I'm going to Pharaoh, we're going to go out and we're going to have a festival, they're probably picturing what I just described to you. Now, if you've seen the Ten Commandments or Prince of Egypt or, you know, maybe even read the Bible, you kind of know how the rest of this story goes. You know, you've got Pharaoh, he denies Moses' request for time off, and then he actually makes life harder. He says, we're going to double and increase the amount of bricks the Hebrew slaves have to produce. And then, of course, we know, many of you that grown up in Sunday school, you've seen those movies, you know about the 10 plagues that followed because Pharaoh would not let them go. And those 10 plagues, if you dig a little bit more deeply into the context of that, you start to see that each of those plagues are actually direct attacks on specific Egyptian gods that would get worshipped at these festivals, which is really interesting. Okay, so then eventually Pharaoh goes, all right, you guys can go. We've had enough. They cross the Red Sea, you know, Charlton Heston holds up the staff. I don't know how they did that back in the day. I think it was like Jell-O or something when they were trying to make the waves part. I don't know how they pulled that off. That was kind of cool for back then. So they pass through the Red Sea, and then they get into the wilderness. And you're like, happily ever after. Not quite, right? In the wilderness, it becomes immediately apparent that these people have no idea how to live. They're complaining about the food. They don't know how to find drinkable water. They get attacked by this marauding tribe called the Amalekites, and it takes a miracle for them to be able to fend off those attacks. Things are not going well out in the wilderness at this point. And so you've got to imagine, after this stuff, they made it out into the wilderness. The people are like, what did we come out here for again? Oh yeah, we were promised a festival. When is that happening? They're waiting for their festival. But things are a mess in the camp. You don't have any written laws yet. The law has not been given to Israel. You've got no instructions or no guide for how to live. So you've got these disputes that are going on in the camp about, you know, basic criminal activity. And Moses' job at this point, his whole day is consumed with, he kind of has to become like the Judge Judy of Israel at this point. There are no written laws. So everybody's just coming to me like, Moses, is this right? Because, you know, my neighbor in the next tent over came over and stole one of my goats. Is that cool? And Moses is like, no, that's not good. You got to give him the goat back. And he's doing this all day long. And eventually Moses' father-in-law tells him, he's like, Moses, this has got to be like the least efficient system ever created. You're going to burn yourself out if all day you're sitting here just judging cases and we don't even have a written code of laws. And so Moses realized, all right, I'm going to delegate this out. Good leadership. I'm going to delegate out. We're going to create a few more judges. But you have to keep in mind, we're talking about anywhere between, and scholars have differences of opinion on how many Israelites are actually out in the wilderness. It could be anywhere between 20,000 to 2 million people out in the wilderness. They've been enslaved. They have had no education in Egypt. They have no written law or governance. This is a mess. Israel desperately needs, they are in desperate need of total, there's a picture there, AI-generated picture of what the common festivals, I forgot to share that one, what it would have looked like, possibly, in Egypt and in Canaan, so we'll change that one for a moment, because you don't want to sit and look at that all day. Israel needed comprehensive guidance on how they ought to live. They needed comprehensive, total guidance. They didn't have anything. Yeah, the law has not been given. They've been enslaved for 400 years. Before that, they were just kind of a wandering family clan in Canaan. So in Exodus 19, they come to Mount Sinai, and God tells Moses to climb up the mountain to meet with him. And God's plan is to give Moses the law to guide his people. Let's look at how this unfolds in Exodus chapter 19. So you can, if you're in your physical Bible, just thumb a few pages over to Exodus 19. We're going to start off at verse 3. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me and obey me fully and keep my commandments, keep my covenant, then out of all the nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. I've talked about this before, I think in the past sermon I gave, but notice God isn't saying to Israel here, out of all the people on the planet, you're going to be the only people that I love. I hate everybody else, but I just like you guys. That's not what's being said here. This is Israel being called and set apart for what we can call, again, a vocational calling. They've got a job to do in the planet. God is setting them apart for a specific role and function. So then Moses, he goes back up the mountain. He's like, everyone's like, yeah, we agree so far, sounds good. He goes back up the mountain, and the mountain is described as having this thick cloud of fire and smoke. People can see the manifest presence of God on Mount Sinai. It's shaking, there's thunder and lightning. The author of Genesis describes God's voice as sounding like the voice of a trumpet. So there in Exodus 20, God begins to give Moses the law. Starting with the Ten Commandments. And I want you to notice the first thing that God says to Moses in the law. Let's jump ahead here. And God spoke all these words. Notice the very first instructions. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below." He is trying to help them understand, I brought you out here into the wilderness to teach you how to worship. But you've got to learn something about the ways and customs of the culture that you've been surrounded in that have worshiped a particular way. And I'm going to show you that's not the way. So here's the thing. You can't worship any other gods before me. Don't make idols. Don't make images. Don't do the things that you've seen your culture doing. In other words, God is telling him, I'm going to teach you rightly ordered worship. I brought you out of Egypt. I know you saw the Egyptians, and the Egyptians at times were wielding this immense power. They were a powerful empire, and the Pharaoh had magicians that were doing sorcery, that Israel saw this stuff, and they're like, these gods have power. I mean, there aren't any atheists in the ancient Near East, okay? This isn't God being like, hey, you know, atheism isn't true. What he's saying is all those gods, the gods that you saw, those dark spiritual forces that you saw, I'm not denying they're not real. But what I'm saying is I'm calling you out of that. So after God gives Moses the Ten Commandments, he comes right back to this point about don't worship any other gods. Take a look. If you jump, scroll down there or turn your Bible to that verse 22 in that same chapter. Notice again, God reemphasizing this point. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites this, you have seen for yourselves that I have spoken to you from heaven. Do not make any gods to be alongside me. Do not make for yourself gods of silver or gods of gold. And then from that point on, God gives Moses all of these other instructions about life for the Israelites and the Hebrew people. Everything from about the laws about treatment of servants to, you know, what we might call personal injury lawsuits. How do we deal with those? Property rights, how you should treat foreigners, widows, and orphans, how you should care for animals. And sometimes we read this stuff and it just seems so obscure, but you have to keep in mind, they don't know how to live at all. And then Moses comes back down the mountain from those set of instructions, and he's like, here's what God says. And then he goes back up one more time. And this time, he takes 40 days on the mountain. And during these 40 days, the specific set of instructions that God is giving to Moses are instructions about worship, about how they should worship. Now, you have to keep in mind, so Moses is on this mountain. Now it's taken a while. He's been up there 40 days. And the people have got to be thinking, we want our festival. When are we going to get our festival? Like, Moses is kind of taking a long time. We've been really, really patient for our festival. Let's see what happens in Exodus 32. So just turn over a few more chapters there to Exodus 32. So, where's our festival, God? Where's our festival? We were promised a festival. Exodus 32, verse 1. We'll start in verse 1 in Exodus 32. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. Aaron answered them, take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me. So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then they said, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord. So the next day, the people rose early, sacrificed burnt offerings, and presented fellowship offerings. Afterwards, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. What are the people doing here? They're having a festival the only way they know how to have a festival. They're doing it just like the Egyptians and before that, the Canaanites, when they were in Canaan. Why did they make a cow out of gold? That seems really random. I remember when I first watched the Ten Commandments as a kid, this scene really stood out to me because they're like, the mountain of God is right there. Why are you guys making a golden cow? That doesn't make any sense at all. But you have to understand that across the ancient Near East, in places like ancient Egypt and in Canaan, you have these bull idols that most often represent some kind of god of fertility. Now, we don't know what specific god they were sacrificing to there. It may be that they were intentionally trying to sacrifice to the bull god of Egypt known as Apis. It could have been a god from the Canaanite culture that was represented via Baal as a bull. Whatever the case may be, we know that the Israelites were worshiping through their normal practices of what a festival was. And it looked just like their pagan neighbors. Now, the NIV here that I was reading from, it's playing it pretty PG, where it says at the end that they, quote, got up to indulge in revelry. The ESV translated as they rose up to play. That's a euphemism, okay? That's a euphemism for the sort of crazed frenzy of X-rated content that people would indulge in at the climax of these ancient pagan festivals. And I heard one scholar try to describe the atmosphere as he said, like, picture like the chaos and frenzy of like the Purge movies. Now, I never saw all those movies, but I saw the trailers and that was enough for me, okay? This is not a, this is not even just like your kind of like Animal House frat party here. This is dark, demonic, abusive, horrific stuff. Now, if God was going to be faithful to his promise to Abraham that his descendants would be a blessing to the world, he had to pull them out of these dark, destructive conceptions of worship. He had to pull them out of these dark, destructive habits. He had to pull them out of the land and culture they were living in for 400 years. God was out to make these people both whole and holy. And I want you just to real quickly look back at the very first instructions. And when you start putting this together, you go, oh my goodness, this makes so much sense. The very first instructions God gave back in Exodus 15, the first command that he gave to Israel, as soon as they crossed over the Red Sea and they crossed into the wilderness, this was the first thing God said, Exodus 15, 26. If you listen carefully to the Lord, your God, and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. It's like God is saying, listen, the Egyptians, they got caught up in all this darkness, and I can't let that kind of darkness spread without end. A good God wouldn't let that happen. An empire built on slave labor, trying to channel and be possessed by dark spiritual forces that drive them into frenzied states of sexual abuse. For your sake and for the sake of the oppressed, I had to shut that down. That's what God's telling them. So God's telling Israel, trust me when I tell you that the instructions I'm giving you for life, that I'm giving you, are intended to keep you away from that end. And they are, in fact, he says specifically, they're intended to lead to your healing. I'm the God that heals you. Now, I recently saw a clip of a kind of an old Saturday Night Live comedian who died a few years ago, a guy by the name of Norm MacDonald. I'm not going to do a Norm MacDonald impersonation. I'll spare you from that. And the guy was interviewing Norm MacDonald, and Norm MacDonald said, you know, the other day I walked into the doctor's office and asked the doctor, Doc, how do I look? And the doc says to me, you know, Norm, you're fat and unhealthy. Unless you change your life, you're going to die in a month or two. And the guy interviewing Norm is kind of like sitting there patiently waiting for the punchline, and nothing happens. And the interviewer says to Norm, well, that's not a very funny joke. And MacDonald quips back, well, of course it's not funny. He's a doctor, not a comedian. You expect my cardiologist to be funny? That's just vintage Norm MacDonald humor right there. But sometimes what it takes to get healthy doesn't sound like good news right away. We can see the law that God gave Israel, and we can see all these prescriptions for life and these ancient rituals about cleanliness and stuff like that. And we don't get the ancient context of that world, and we think, really, God? Like, was all of that actually necessary? And the answer is, yeah, it was. It was, yes, it was definitely necessary. It's kind of like if you go to a personal trainer and you say, hey, like, I want to lose a few pounds. I need to get in shape. And you sit down with that personal trainer, and he's like, here's what I want you to do. I want you to keep a food journal of everything you eat. I want you to keep track of your macros, and I want you to be in a caloric deficit every week, okay? And you go back, and you're like, yeah, is all that really necessary? He's like, no, yeah, it is. It doesn't sound like good news. In fact, you might sit and listen to that nutritionist or personal trainer, and you might get this sense of like, oh, this is a really restrictive fence that's keeping me away from an endless sea of donuts. And you're like, and it's like, yeah, you could think of it that way. You could think of the law as a fence that's keeping you away from all of the stuff that happens at these festivals. Or you could see that guide as trying to lead you away from destruction and into health and wholeness. Egypt, the Israelites came out of Egypt without an education, without laws or governments, and God was good enough to give them a comprehensive set of instructions for nearly every single facet of life for their time and culture. But you might still recognize that and go, yeah, Paul, yeah, that makes sense. But like, are all these instructions for me today? Like, do I really need to get something out of, let's say, the law that prescribes you have to wear a blue cord attached to your turban if you're the high priest? Is there something in that law for me? Preachers probably shouldn't say this. No, there isn't. I mean, there's nothing specifically about that law for you right here and right now. The exact details of the guidance to Israel aren't for you, but the guide who gives it is. You see, times and cultures change, and as the good news of God's righteous and just kingdom spread through Jesus Christ, the gospel of Jesus Christ, to the ends of the earth, God knew it was going to extend beyond an ancient Near Eastern culture. It was going to extend beyond the bounds and customs of Israel. Because of that reality, there would be no way to create an ever-expanding book of precise laws for every single situation, for all cultures and all times. You can't do that. That wasn't God's intention in the long run. Like, what is the biblical prescription for how much screen time you should have every day? I hate to break it to you, but the Bible doesn't specifically address that, because smartphones didn't exist and TVs didn't exist back then. So if you go looking and go, I need a biblical law for everything in my life, that's missing the point of the gospel. That's not to say we dismiss the stuff, but that's to say God had another plan in mind, which is to help us recognize the goodness of the guide and his guidance that he gives for us. And so we can see the Apostle Paul outline this and explain this change. In Galatians 3:23, you don't have to turn there now, I'll just put it up on the screen. Listen to what the Apostle Paul writes. Before the coming of this faith, we were held in custody under the law, locked up until the faith that was to come would be revealed. So the law was our guardian until Christ came, that we might be justified by faith. Now that this faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian. There's an old saying that you are what you eat, or you become what you behold. Worship is about what we believe is worthy of our attention. And so the life of following the way of Jesus is about rightly ordered attention. It's about attending to the things that God has called us to do in the world. It's about attending to his order. It's about, I think Pastor Jay has used this phrase before, it's about learning how to go with the grain of God's intended order for reality instead of our lives brushing up always against the grain. We become what we behold. Just like the ancient Egyptians were attempting to behold in their festivals these dark forces, and that darkness and destruction began to spread because they gave their attention to those things. The question about, well, how much screen time is allowed for me as a Christian? And you know, back in my youth group days, it was like, well, can you see a rated R movie or not? That sort of question, I get it. Or a question about, like, how much money should I spend on myself versus giving away? These are all really good questions. And there are questions that I hate to break it to you, but I actually think it's better news. These are questions the Bible does not give you a direct law about. We don't have direct instructions about how much screen time is healthy or what's a good movie to watch or not a good movie to watch. The point is not that we are trying to find this law and prescription for every single thing in the Bible. The point of our lives is to have our lives conform to the risen Christ that we find in the pages of the scriptures. So instead of thinking like the Bible is like, hey, what is the biblical law about how much screen time I should have every day? I'd say, let's reframe the question differently here. I think a better question is, what's worthy of my attention? And who am I trying to become? Like God bringing Israel out of Egypt to show them a better way, there may be some things that you realize as you reflect. Normal features of American culture, of the broader Western culture, that you realize as you reflect and you get to know the Jesus of the scriptures and you go, I don't think that's worthy of my attention. And I think if I give that attention, I'm not becoming more Christ-like. So the better question becomes not, well, what's the like legal prescription for number hours of screen time per day? I think a better question is the attention I'm giving to these screens making me more Christ-like? And if it isn't, then you cut it out, right? In some ways, it's like better news. In some ways, it's almost more simple. Just like God bringing Israel out of Egypt to show them a better way, there might be some things that you realize as you reflect on this right now that are normal features of our culture that you go, when I think about this, the more I think about it, I realize this isn't worthy of my attention. And it's not bringing me into the wholeness of life in Christ. So in your bulletin, we're going to take a moment here just to give you space to reflect. I don't want to just go, hey, let's jump into singing right now, and then you walk out and you go, hey, what's for lunch today? So at the bottom of your bulletin there, I've asked you a couple questions, and we're going to take a few minutes now. You know, the worship team can come back up and start playing. Here's the first question I want you to think about, and we're just going to give you like a minute or two to just respond. Write down what comes to mind. The first question is, when I give too much attention to blank, I don't like the person I become in these ways. I'll give you one example from my own life. Probably 10, 15 years ago, it dawned on me. There is a direct correlation between the amount of time I spend watching cable news and how anxious and how angry I am at the world. So I cut it out. I didn't go like, well, what's the legal limit of the amount of time of cable news? There wasn't anything in the Bible about that, but I realized it wasn't making me more Christ-like. So I go, I'm not doing that. I'm doing that less. I cut out the talk radio stuff, and I actually found I was less anxious. I was more like whole and healthy, and my life was looking more like Christ. That's one example. And then the second question, I'm going to give you time to reflect on both of these, is the flip side of that. When I give proper attention to God through this, I notice I become more Christ-like in these ways. So for example, you might realize, I notice that when I'm driving in my car, instead of filling myself with stuff that might make me anxious or angry, like I turn on worship music, or I listen to like an audiobook reading of the scriptures. And when I do that, I feel myself becoming more whole and healthy in the life of Christ. So I'm gonna give you now just 2 minutes. You could probably write on this for much longer. Take 2 minutes and just write down some of the things that come to mind right now. You might even notice right now, even as we're doing this, you might notice that even just the little sliver of this day that I dedicated to saying, God, I want no other gods before you, you felt something different in you. I notice in my life, the days where I get out of bed and the first thing I do is my knees hit the floor next to my bed and I give thanks to God for the day, I don't do it every day. I'm trying to increase that, but I notice on those days, this isn't prosperity gospel stuff. I'm not saying the rest of the day is magically perfect. It's not like I didn't have any problems that day because I just got up and I prayed every morning. I'm not telling you that. But what I notice is more of that life of Christ in me as I'm going through the day. I notice a greater sense of wholeness, even if the world around me feels chaotic. So I want to encourage you to continue to reflect on this. Take your bulletin home. Don't just toss it on the way out. Take time to reflect and maybe begin to think about, what am I going to give less attention to? What am I going to give more attention to as my goal is to become like Christ? I want to invite us all now. We didn't pray at the beginning of the sermon. I want to invite you all now to stand and to participate in a responsive prayer together.
I invite you to read aloud with me this prayer. There's something to be said for individual reflection, but when we do that as a community, it just provides a different space for us to commune with God and kind of be more in touch with where we're at as we go forward through our day. Dear Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you have called us to be salt and light in a world where there is much brokenness and darkness. You have called us out of this darkness into your glorious light, to love those around us as you have loved us, strengthened by the grace that you generously give. You have made us into your image, and through the gospel, we are being made more human. Grant to us the grace to see your light shining brightly in this city and in our world, so that we can see the glimpses of glory that surround us each day. Open our eyes to see what is unseen, to be overwhelmed by the unfading glory that surrounds us, so that our hearts may be freed from our idols to serve the one true living God. Open our hearts to the holiness of worship. Guide us to participate in the community that worship provides. Lead us in your truth, hope, mercy, and love. You are worthy of all our adoration. Amen.